Welcome to Indie Piece, an in-depth look at the independently developed video games that we call masterpieces. Presented by OK Beast, I'm your host, Blessing Adeoye. Yo, what's up? Welcome to Indie Piece. Indie Piece is a podcast series dedicated to celebrating the independently created video games that we hail as masterpieces of the medium. Every episode, we take a look at a different indie game, deconstruct it, and analyze what makes it a work of art and stand out among the rest. On this podcast, we'll be taking a look at indie side-scrollers, walking sims, physics games, and games that have broken the mold of the medium. Season 1, we've taken a look at games such as Celeste, Gone Home, and Undertale. We're going to talk about a few more games, such as Cuphead next episode and Hellblade: Senua's Sacrifice 2 episodes from now. This episode, we're discussing... Inside. I'm your host, Blessing Adeoye. Joining me, we have Chase Williams, a product manager at NO Games. Chase, how's it going?
I am doing great. It is... fantastic to be sitting across the computer from you again, Blessing. Always a joy to podcast together. I'm excited to talk about Inside. Not only is it one of my favorite games ever, but it also came out about the time that you and I were starting to collaborate and write at the first time. So kind of a nice nostalgic through line there too.
I want to say when I first launched the OKBs podcast, one of the first episodes we did was actually like an episode with me and you, and we talked about Inside.
Yeah.
And I wish I went back and listened to that episode before this so I could reference it. But like revisiting this podcast, like when I was setting this podcast up and going through the games I wanted to talk about, as soon as I hit Inside, I was like, oh, I got to talk to Chase about Inside.
Yeah. Well, I'm happy that my name came up when you were thinking about that game.
Oh, yeah. No, for sure. And I also want to give a shout out because like this is going to be, I believe, the only episode of this season of Indie Piece that is only two of us talking as opposed to three. All the other episodes have had two guests. This is the first episode that is basically a one-on-one, which is really cool. And also I want to give a shout out to you because the reason I'm having you on is because, you know Inside, the game. I know you have a love for Inside. But you also have a history with OK Beast. You did the what was the name of the podcast series that you've done a couple seasons of now?
That was The Greatest Game.
The Greatest Game, yeah. Where you kind of touch on art and philosophy, and you have a pretty good understanding of some of those concepts as it pertains to video games. And you've also worked with you also have a good history in the industry now. You also worked at Sony San Diego. And where else have you worked?
So, right now I'm at NO Games over in Germany, and I also work for a small studio called Hellfire Games in Austin.
Nice.
But, yeah, you're right. I do spend a lot of time researching academic sources and how they relate to video games, and it's actually words like masterpiece and words like art that kind of drove me to that entire endeavor a few years ago now at this point. And so that's another reason why I'm excited to do this show with you, is so that we can try to explore what those words mean and why we do give them to certain games over others, right?
Yeah. So let's talk about Inside. Coming into this episode, what's your story with Inside? What are your feelings on the game?
Yeah, so I mean, just thinking back to when I played it for the first time, I was a big fan of Limbo, which is Playdead's first game that they put out, which is also a game that sort of is a footnote in the history, I think, of digital games and especially of like indie game development. And it made a big impact on people because it was expressive in a way that video games really hadn't been up until that point, or at least it was a little more rare. And so I think there was a lot of anticipation to see what Playdead would do next. And that's definitely how I was thinking of the title. And I remember when their trailer came out, and I actually went back and watched the trailer before recording this episode, and I still think it's one of the most impactful trailers for a game out there. Like, it's just, it asks so many questions. Like, there's so many question marks after you see that trailer. And so finally getting, when it released, you know, I got it, and I played through it in, like, two sittings, and I just remember leaving the room and going to talk to my girlfriend at the time and just saying, like, I cannot believe what I just like saw. I cannot believe what I just played. Like, I was totally flabbergasted and speechless. And that speechlessness is exactly why this game has the reputation that it has.
Yeah, no, 1,000%. Replaying the game for this episode, I hadn't played the game since, I think 2016 is when the game came out. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't played the game since it came out. And so replaying it for the first time in almost 3 years, I had forgotten like how expertly crafted this game is, from like the animation to like the simplicity of it, to the design of the puzzles in the I guess level. I don't even know if I can call them levels, but the world design, I guess, all just like fascinating in terms of how they tackled it, but also just like really well done and really quality.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So let's get into some game facts. Of course, Inside was developed by Playdead. Who is Playdead? Playdead is a Danish independent video game developer based in Copenhagen. Game designers Arnt Jensen and Dino Patty created the company in 2006 to develop Limbo, which released in 2010 to critical acclaim. During Xbox's E3 2014 conference, Playdead announced their second game, Inside, which was a spiritual successor to Limbo. It was released for Xbox One, Microsoft Windows, and PlayStation 4 in 2016 to critical acclaim, and was hailed as a worthy successor to Limbo. And you kind of touched on your thoughts on Limbo real quick and when you're talking about Inside, but like Limbo, I'm with you in terms of like what it meant for digital games and indie games when it first came out. I think Limbo is probably the first, like, in terms of indie games as we know indie games today, Limbo was probably the first one I could remember seeing and being like, oh, this looks cool, like this looks really dope, because I think G4 was still on TV at the time.
god rest his soul.
Yeah, and I was a kid watching G4 and I was like, this game looks really cool, because they're showing it off. How do you feel about Limbo now compared to Inside in terms of like what they mean for each other?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. Like, I remember playing Limbo for the first time and being very struck by it, and thought that it deserved the praise that it was receiving at the time. And I agreed with much of the acclaim that came its way. But when you play Inside, you really recognize that there is a lineage. The ideas in Inside seem like they are they started in Limbo, but were able to reach a more realized end, in so to speak. Mm-hmm. But I actually replayed Limbo after I played Inside, a year or so ago, because I was just, I was in this mindset of really, I was so in awe of Inside as a game, and just wanted to play the other work. And I do think that Inside, in some ways, is so much better than Limbo that it actually it's going to spoil, I think, Limbo's experience a little bit. And I think that also speaks to why we consider Inside to be such a high achievement, is because it does take that foundation and makes it, in my opinion, so good that when you see Limbo, you can appreciate Limbo for what it was at the time, but Inside does make Limbo feel dated. And that, I think, is an incredible thing, considering how good Limbo is on its own and was on its own at the time, without having known that Inside would come in the future.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I want to say, I was having this debate or argument or conversation a while ago with a few people talking about like, okay, what was better between Inside and Limbo, and I can't remember what I cited on. I want to say I sided with Limbo before, because like it's the conversation when it comes down to like influence versus iteration or innovation. Mm-hmm. Because like Inside, I think by and far, especially having now replayed it again, every facet of Inside, every element of Inside, I feel like is Limbo taken to the next level. And Limbo, but like when Limbo came out, there was nothing else like it, right? And right. So like, for, I think Limbo probably paved the way more.
Absolutely.
than Inside. But after replaying Inside again, I'm like, man, Inside is just a fantastic, fantastic game. And if I was to have that conversation today, right now, I'll definitely put Inside way above Limbo for a lot of the things it does now.
Right. Yeah. And like, you can only discover something once, and the
the
value of the experience of discovering something is always going to be very powerful. But when you talk about would Inside be possible without Limbo? I do tend to say that actually, yes, it would, because when you think about the core building blocks of what the game is it's really quite simple. It's just a side-scrolling game. And, you know, I think there's definitely an argument to be made that Limbo was the game that allowed them to put their ideas on paper, polish them to a degree that they were able to see, you know, what they're able to accomplish, and then they could... They still had, you know, some rocket sauce left in the tank, creativity to move mm-hmm. on to Inside. But I think side by side, you know, you may be able to cite some technological innovation that happened between the two that may not have been possible. But mm-hmm. I do think there's something to be said that in the simplicity of the genre, which is just a 2D side-scrolling light puzzle game, you know, that kind of could have existed at any point in time, once 3D rendering was up to snuff, you know?
Oh, yeah, no, for sure. So, to continue on with Who Is Play Dead, Arne Jensen, a former IO Interactive developer, drew sketches in 2004 that led him to conceptualize Limbo. Having tried programming himself, he eventually sought for additional help through an art-based teaser for the game in 2006. This led to a meeting between Jensen and Dino Patty. Patty soon realized the project was larger than the two of them, and together they founded the company, initially using their private funds and government grants before obtaining larger investments. Playdead eventually came to have 8 employees during Limbo's development, with temporary increases of up to 16 through freelancers. Limbo's success led them to be able to reacquire the company back from investors, making Playdead completely independent. Within the same year as Limbo's release, Playdead began working on Project 2, what would later become Inside. The game was partially financed by the Danish Film Institute. Considered a spiritual successor to Limbo, Inside has many of the same themes, including being a 2.5D platform game using a primarily monochrome palette. After using a custom game engine for Limbo, Playdead used Unity to simplify development and a custom temporal anti-aliasing filter, which was released in March 2016 under an open-source license. The game was officially announced at E3 2014 with planned release in 2015. It was later pushed to mid-2016 for further refinement, but had a demo at PAX Prime in August 2015. Martin Stig Anderson created the soundtrack again after Limbo, creating sound via bone conduction with a human skull. Wow. I forgot all about that.
Yep.
Yeah, and we can talk about that right now, actually, because like the replaying Inside, I forgot about how there is a seeming, like, at first I was like, for the first, like, I'll say like 30 minutes, I was like, is there no soundtrack to this game? And then when sound starts to kick in, and when those musical moments start to kick in, it's just like, it's not a soundtrack as you would expect a soundtrack to be in a video game. It is very atmospheric, and it is very, the sound design is just very unique in terms of just what the, like, the effects they're going for. Like, for example, when you hear the shockwave, when you get to the shockwave portion of the game, and you hear the build up and the punch through of the shockwave,
it sounds
incredible.
It's powerful.
It's super powerful. And yeah, the idea that they were able to get that sound from bone conduction with a human skull just makes it super cool.
Yeah, so their composer, essentially, he had been a composer by university trade, and so he had even composed symphonies and things like that. And then he got into some more experimental sound design, where he would take recordings of things like cars and traffic and try to basically take sound out of those that would have musical qualities. So he was like, he's a very musically oriented person and views noise as something that he can like play with. Mm-hmm. And they said that when they were doing the score for this game, they were using kind of like typical synthesizers, because they were going for sort of like a 1980s aesthetic. But like in all of the post-processing that they did, it just seemed like the sound was so distinct from the game that it was more of like a statement than it was like actually like threading into the experience as a piece mm-hmm. of it rather than like standing apart. And one of the, it ends up what they did to make the sound get the resonance that they wanted is he piped it through a human skull, like you said. And he even mentioned that like you can hear a little bit of the vibration of like the teeth in the sound. Wow. And he mentions how, and like, you know, this guy is a very like artistic dude who is clearly out there and very creative. And so he's like explaining how even the vibration of the teeth is probably something that's somewhat familiar to the human brain, just on a level that may not always be like recognizable. And so, yes, even the theme of being inside was relayed through the sound design and having the music supposed to sound like it's coming from inside your own head, essentially. Which is just out there. And like, that's the kind of like vision and like non-compromising sort of process that creates a game as unique as Inside. And then that gives that sound a register that is unlike anything you hear when you play a different game. And, you know, like you said, they use sound and music very sparingly. And so when it does come on, it's known, like it makes its presence felt, and it adds to the expression of what is happening on the screen. And it's great.
Yeah. Oh, it's absolutely incredible. And I think a recurring thing that's going to come through on this podcast when we're talking about Inside is just the detail that they put in to every facet of the game. Because like playing this game yesterday, I got to a part where I can't remember what was exactly going on, but essentially there are different surfaces through which I was running through. Like there was like the regular ground, and then like I think I ran down a ramp into like a different room, and then I forget what the surface of that room was, but the footsteps of the boy you're playing as on each of those surfaces sounded different. It sounded unique to the room he was in and the surface he was running on. And just there, like, I feel like what they're going for with Inside is super felt from that. And that kind of reverberates through, like, all the different elements of what they're going for in the game. And I'm going to talk about the animation later and, like, the puzzles and all that stuff. But, like, the detail is pretty ridiculous when it comes to this game. Let's get into some of the plot and setup of the game. So starting with plot. A boy slides down a rocky incline while running through a forest. He encounters masked guards with flashlights, as well as vehicles with mounted spotlights and fierce guard dogs. He escapes the guards, then crosses a road where a block has been set up with more vehicles and guards to a farm where parasitic worms cause pigs to run rampant. The boy uses the farm animals and equipment to escape to a seemingly abandoned city where lines of zombie-like people are moved through mind control. Beyond the city is a large factory of flooded rooms, a shockwave atrium, and a laboratory environment where scientists perform underwater experiments on bodies. So Inside is a game with seemingly just no exposition. Like, there's not really anybody speaking. There's not really any dialogue given verbally or, like, read. This has a huge effect on the setting of the game, as Inside is focused on a mysterious facility with lots of weird stuff going on. How do we feel about Inside's approach to setting?
Yeah, I mean, the fact, what you just mentioned, that there's not a single letter, button prompt, word, anything in the game is something that I immediately took to after my first playthrough, and that I really think is one of the best aspects of it. It's almost difficult to speak about this game in terms of plot and in terms of narrative.
Yeah.
There are certainly memorable moments, but there is a dreamlike quality to Inside. There is a surreal chain of events that is happening. And when you are running through the world, you are at all times basically running to the right and going downwards. Yeah. And even though you are progressing in that way and you can feel that as the player because you're moving your character in that direction, there are just moments where after you've been underwater for like 15 minutes going miles down below the surface, the next room that you end up in looks like you just came onto a beach. And so it's almost impossible to actually explain the how and the why of what is explicitly happening on the screen. And that's why I like to speak of Inside as if it were sort of like a dream. And I do like to call Inside like highly illogical. It does mm-hmm. not operate on a logic that is reflected in the real world. It's like if you try to explain it in terms that make most sense, even as like a fantasy or a science fiction plot, you're going to continually run into loose and open ends, and you're going to continue to find answer or questions that don't have answers. And that can be very frustrating for people who are looking for like, an ability to close the book essentially and come to a final interpretation. But this is a game that is really open to interpretation for as long as you wish to interpret it. Like there are fan theories out there and they're really fun to read, but none of them really carry weight as being a definitive answer. And when this game first released, I would get very frustrated listening to people speak about it because they would criticize the game for that. They would say, oh, the end of the game, there's not enough closure. It doesn't tell me what this was all about. And like, to me, that's sort of its greatest strength, is that it resists that kind of interpretation. And in the way that I'm explaining that they sort of like stitch together environments in a manner that doesn't really seem to make sense, they are kind of exploiting the human brain's capability of making meaning. Because if you think about film, and this was like an experiment run like early on in film's lifespan, but if you take two cuts, like two sequences of images, and put them together and watch them, you can in literally only two edits, right? Just two images, but sequenced in one particular way, you can kind of come up with a reason as to why those two images, as to why one of those follows the other. But then if you take those same images and just reverse them, it can totally change the meaning of what you saw in the second one. And so that is just to explain that like the human brain is going to make sense of things, and putting all of these sort of environments together, and I wouldn't really call them random, like they definitely flow visually, but just kind of stitching them together without much meaningful purpose just allows your own imagination to think about it. And that's another aspect of this game that I find so remarkable, you know?
Do you feel like there is a final interpretation that can be had from either what was given to us, or like, do you think that there is a final interpretation that even the developers have for this game, or do you think it was created with the purpose of not having a definitive interpretation that can be had from what was given?
Yeah, so I think that their goal was to make something that was open. But to answer your question about if even they actually came out, let's say like 3 weeks later and said, no, the game is about this, that wouldn't really matter. Like at that point in time, that would be their interpretation of the game.
And interesting.
That's what's really great about great works of art and great aesthetic objects, is that once they're out in the world, they exist basically on their own legs. Like they are essentially a child, and their parents were the developers. They were the artist. And so that artifact, that object that they created, is going to be maybe conducive to certain types of interpretation. Like we can't say that this game is a farming simulator, right? Like we can't say this game is about Indiana Jones. So there's definitely some interpretations that don't work. But even if the developers tried to tell us explicitly what the game was about, the fact that it exists on its own and in the fashion that it does means that basically for perpetuity, any player who picks it up will probably have something different to say about it, you know?
Yeah. I also like the game for that. I when you get to the end of the game where you're playing as the big old blob and you are trying to escape as the blob, or you at least you understand it is trying to escape, right?
Yeah.
There comes moments where like the people in the place are like helping you out and like opening doors and trying to like guide you toward the outside.
Yes.
And even as a player, like watching all that, I'm like, okay, are they helping me because they want good for me, or are they helping me because they're afraid of me? Like why are they trying to trick me into getting out? Like what is going on here?
Yes.
The idea that like there are so many elements where I'm like, I don't know what's happening. But like there are ways I can make sense of it, but mm-hmm. none of those ways seems like it can be a definitive answer. I think kind of makes this game cool, and I kind of enjoy the storytelling for that. Right. A question I want to ask is like,
sure.
later in the narrative, right, or not in the narrative, later in the game, there comes the siren that tries to kill you at first, and then sort of helps you out. Like, did you feel like was there any interpretation of that you kind of found to be satisfactory for you? Because I'm still confused about the whole situation with the siren and what the siren meant and what it kind of wanted to do.
Yeah, I think, you know, I kind of have an overarching interpretation myself that I think we'll probably get into in like a more holistic way at the end. Mm-hmm. And even in that interpretation, I don't really have much room for that siren or for that mermaid character. And I think that the mermaid or the siren plays an important role, which is why I think there should be an answer there. And it would probably require me to give it more thought. But the siren ends up drowning the boy and essentially killing the child. And that gives a sequence of like rebirth and it's done in the water. So there's almost like a baptismal type of like metaphor going on there, at least the way that I look at it. And so the fact that that is at the hands of this siren character, I think should imbue it with some sort of meaning. But I think the easy answer is that it was another one of the experiments of the scientists that existed in this world and essentially had its own desires and will for the boy and was able to essentially enact them, you know?
Interesting. So to continue on with the plot, while traversing these areas, the boy uses a mind control helmet to control lifeless gray bodies. The boy eventually comes across an underwater siren-like creature that attaches a device to him, allowing him to breathe underwater. Continuing, and also I should even mention, because we talked a lot about how kind of amorphous a lot of the portions of the plot are in terms of what they're trying to communicate. I'm getting all of this reading from, like in the other episodes, from Wikipedia. And okay. I make edits here or there and so that they kind of fit my understanding. But that said, all of what I'm reading right here is mostly just the interpretation from Wikipedia. And so, I feel like this game is best experienced played. And I feel like everybody kind of has their own interpretation of the plot and of the game as we were kind of talking about. And so just putting that out there as I'm continuing reading on.
Sure.
The siren-like creature attaches the device to him, allowing him to breathe underwater. Continuing through the office and laboratories, the boy sees scientists observing a large spherical chamber, which is a great scene. Yeah. And everything leading up to that scene is amazing.
Yeah, and it's so cool how that scene in particular is basically the start of the final act of the game, and it's also in the trailer. Like, it's like, I love that. Like, I love when you watch the trailer. The game is so amorphous and ambiguous that they show you the end of the game right there. You know, I love
it. Yeah, it's awesome. And I think, like, even right before that scene, there's a scene where you're in this... I don't even know whether I can call it an office room, but you're in a room looking down through a window and you see characters running to where the blob is.
Yeah.
And it's such a great shot. And like, props to this game. There are so many great shots that this game has, like great like visual moments. Mm-hmm. But that one in particular is really cool because I think like that I would probably mark as the end of the second act / beginning of the third act.
Yes.
Transition. That kind of leads into that big portion of the game. The boy enters the chamber and discovers a large blob-like creature, the Huddle, as they call it on Wikipedia. I don't know if it's officially called the Huddle, but I think we're going to call it the Huddle. Blob. Yeah, I've been calling it the Blob. Made of humanoid limbs connected to four control rods. After disconnecting the rods, the boy is pulled from into the Huddle. The Huddle escapes confinement, crashing through offices, killing some of the scientists in its path. The scientists trap the Huddle in another tank, but the Huddle escapes again and breaks through a wooden wall. It rolls down a forest hill and comes to a stop at a grassy coastline, bathed in light. And that's kind of where the plot ends. What is the deal with the Huddle / the Blob, and how do we feel about the way it was handled in the game?
Yeah, so without going into like what I think the blob is as like a metaphor and things like that, I will just speak about the moment that that fucking thing was revealed in the game. You know, you've been playing as the boy for an hour and a half at this point, and you see this big spherical tank. Next thing you know, you're underneath it and you're trying to get in. Then you're launched into it, and the boy is swimming into the water, and he's naked at this point. And as you are, and you see this blob, and you're like, what the fuck is this thing, right? Like, it is gross, and it just is very unsettling. It's super off-putting to look at. Like, at just like as a basic human response, it's like this, it's very gory, right? It's like body, it's like body horror. And you see this thing, and you're trying to like unlatch it from this contraption, and it just sucks you in. And like, that is the moment, that is like the turn of the game, where you're just like, what is what? And next thing you know, you're controlling it, and then you break out of the tank, and you're fucking running through this office, tearing walls down as this gigantic fleshy mass with arms and limbs sticking out, and you can hear the people inside like yelling and groaning. And, you know, to talk about like when that was happening as a player, my eyes were just wide open and my jaw was on the floor. And it's, you know, to even, you know, harken back to what we were talking about a second ago with making meaning just off of seeing images, like, it's this thing where, imagine a Rorschach test where someone shows you like an ink blot and you're like, oh, I think this ink blot means this thing. Imagine instead of an ink blot, they're just like, what do you think this fucking blob is running through the fucking hallways right now, dude? And you're like, I have no idea. I can't even tell you what's happening. Like, at that moment, I feel like the player is so deep into the experience of the game that they don't even really are aware of what's happening. They're just playing and they're just seeing. And it is like, ugh. That moment right there is one of the reasons, like, the feeling of just insanity that accompanies that is a huge thing that I latch onto as why the game is so impactful, right?
Yeah, and even from just like a design and technology perspective of the blob and how just like all everything encompassing that thing visually and sound wise, like you kind of mentioned, it is off the chain. I've not seen anything like it. Because like, you're controlling it, the way it kind of moves, it moves so naturally, and so like the physicality of it almost feels like it's not even a video game anymore. Like, it feels like it feels like you should be watching a cutscene that somebody put together, but like, you're controlling it. Yeah, exactly. And like, there comes a part where like, you have to like get a box and then put it on fire so that you can like ignite this thing over here, right? But like, after you put, you're playing as a blob, right? And after you ignite the box, sprinklers go off, and you have to throw the box over the sprinklers, and the movement of it just looks so natural. And even like, as you're throwing the box over the sprinklers, catching it, throwing it again, it feels super natural, it feels super easy. But you're watching it and you're like I was on the edge of my seat the first time I played, and I was like, I don't want to drop this thing, I want to make sure I get this right, I don't want to like mess this up. But like, even though you're in full control, what you're looking at on screen just looks so natural, and like, it's naturally disgusting also. Yes. Like, the thing just looks like it's in pain. I think it is expressing that it is in pain,
right? Yeah, judging
from some of the sounds it's making. It's horrific. Super horrific. But yeah, like, now that we've kind of reached the blob, I want to ask you a question. I didn't even include in the doc, but now, but now that we're here, I do want to ask you this question. What is your interpretation of Inside? Because it's it's a lot.
To kind of
take in.
Yeah, and I break it down in sort of like a literary component. Like, when you look at like what does it mean for the game that it only moves left and right, for example. Like, I think I think the left and right movement is this sort of a sort of destiny inevitability theme in the game. Like, no matter, like, once you've played, like, the first time you play the game, you think you're escaping. And then you slowly realize that like, getting deeper into this facility. And then after you've beaten the game, you're like, what the fuck? Was I trying to do that the whole time? Mm-hmm. And so like there's an inevitability there that's really cool. But to basically kind of hit you with my philosophical interpretation of the game is, and this also I think speaks to the game's power as an aesthetic object. Like in the research that I've done about how some people think about the word artworks is that they say that the best artworks essentially like critique society. And through playing them, we learn something about ourselves or our nature that cannot be unlearned. And when I play Inside, I view it as a warning of collectivist ideology, like collectivist thought. And collectivist ideology is just the idea of elevating a particular group of people over the individuals who are in that group. And that can be that can be a group of people with any sort of shared trait. So whether it be something as simple as your gender, or if it's something like being born in the same year, any sort of way that you can group people is a potential form, can be the basis for a collectivist mentality. And so in the way that I think about collectivism is that you may try to support one group instead of thinking of them as individuals, but the individuals always exist. And to me, that is most, and not only that, but the individuals aren't thought of as, they're not on the same plane as the group, and therefore they can be expended at the group's expense. And so I view that the pain from that conclusion as the blob. Like to me, the blob is, in my mind, the perfect metaphor for collectivism. It is this
interesting
amalgamation of human bodies and individual mass that has been forced together by all of these experiments that was clearly done against these people's will. You know, you start at the very beginning of the game and the people that you come across are from farmland, which means they were outside of the city, they're away from the scientific centers, and so they were looked at as basically fodder. Like they no longer were individuals, and instead they were just a means to whatever end the scientists had. And the end of their essentially experiment was the blob. And even though the blob exists and it works, you can still hear the human individual pain in those voices of the people screaming out and groaning as it moves. And it is just this tortured soul that exists in horror, basically.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, I mean, how does that hit you, man? Because that's, and granted, that's also an interpretation, right? Like I would, it's totally possible to draw other conclusions, but as when it comes to from my own personal background and what I brought to the game, that's how I ended up seeing it.
Yeah, and I still have no idea how I view what's going on in this game. Like, I actually didn't really take the time when the game originally came out to, like, look for and, like, seek out a bunch of different interpretations. Because after playing it, I was kind of like, I kind of liked the mystery, and I kind of enjoyed the idea of, like, thinking of it for myself. I felt like a lot of it just couldn't be explained, and so I didn't necessarily, like, feel the need to even like try. But like I feel what you're saying there, and I can definitely see that is a good interpretation. How do you feel about the idea that like it's the blob that is controlling the kid that you're playing as to come and free it?
Because I
think that could feed into like the idea like the collectivist idea. I guess the individuals in the collective trying to like free their own selves
from that.
I don't know,
I think it begins to complicate my own interpretation, which is why I actually don't actively think about the sort of secret ending of the game, which allows you to essentially turn a computer off and it kills the game right there, like the game ends. But there is something to be said of like when you were talking about when the scientists are trying to like help you, or are they trying to help you? Like, and even in the scene that you mentioned where you can see down below into the final chamber where the blob exists and you see people running towards it, you're almost like, am I a part of this fucking experiment? Like, are these people trying to basically see if they can successfully get the boy here, or do they know that the blob is attracting people? And in that case, I also think that, like, once the blob escapes, it escapes because it crashes through, like, many levels of floors. And I think at that moment, it essentially, like, is free of their control, like, of the scientist's control. And that's why you see them as, like, more fearful. And when they're trying to, like, help you, they're really just trying to get you back into a fucking cage, which feeds back into, like, my... like collectivist interpretation is that it's about control ultimately. Like, there's always going to be one group of people who is subverting their control over the other ones. But as far as the blob controlling the boy, I think I could try to, like, give meaning towards it through the lens of what I'm currently using to interpret it. But I don't think that I don't have, like, a really good answer for it, you know?
Yeah, and while doing research for this episode, that was one of the theories that I came across before I even replayed the game. So as I was playing the game, I was trying to keep a lookout for it and be like, okay, does this make sense? And once again, like, shout out to Playdead with how they designed Inside, because as the boy was disconnecting the cables that was connected to the blob, I was keeping a lookout to see, like, okay, like, is he gonna disconnect the last cable? Does that disprove the theory? And, like, as you connect the third to last cable, the second to last cable, it sucks you in, and then it disconnects itself. And I was like, dang, like, they're so they did an expert job of, like, trying to keep things as, like, smooth as possible for people trying to interpret this to interpret it any way they want.
Yeah,
because even that, like, thwarted that, like, that theory. I was like, dang, I could still take that either way. Like, I can't really make have a definitive answer off of whether or not, like, that was the clue, like, that was the thing.
Sure.
Yeah, it's crazy. So let's get into the setup of Inside. So Inside is a puzzle platformer. The player character is an unnamed boy who explores a surreal environment presented as a monochromatic 2.5D platform game. The game is dark, with color used sparingly to highlight parts of the environment, and mostly silent, with occasional musical cues. The player controls a boy who walks, runs, swims, climbs, and uses objects to overcome obstacles and progresses in the game. The boy gains the ability to control bodies to complete certain puzzles. At various points in the game, the player may discover hidden rooms containing glowing orbs. If all the orbs are deactivated during a playthrough, the player unlocks the game's alternate ending. The boy can die in various ways, such as being shot with a tranquilizer dart, mauled by dogs, ensnared by security machines, blown apart by shockwaves, or drowning. As in the predecessor game Limbo, these deaths are presented realistically and are often graphic. If the character dies, the game continues from the most recent checkpoint. So, does the violence and shock value of Inside add to the experience and the core message of what the game wants to communicate? What do you think, Chase?
Yes, absolutely. Like, I think it is certainly a part of the character of the game and a part of the game's, like, personality. Like, it is wrapped up in the fingerprint of what Inside is. And there's a, honestly, like, a dark comedic aspect to the deaths. Like, I think after you've played through the game for a period of time, you may want to go in there and just try to figure out how many ways you can die. And that also speaks to the level of, like, procedural polish that the game has, in that any way that you can kind of think of a fail state in the game, it's probably going to support it with, like, a somewhat unique death sequence.
Yeah.
Which is really cool to see how detail-oriented the game is. And so, yes, you have it as, like, there's a dark comedic effect. It's something that just puts the game, that gives the game a character and puts it away from other games that you play in terms of it being a distinguishing factor. And then I also think that it falls into the interpretation of it being a dystopian fiction, right? Like, in this world that is about control, the only thing that matters is the use of force, which is, like, a pure dystopia. And so anytime anybody with free will essentially is seen outside of the system, they're fucking killed immediately. And I think that also speaks to just the fiction of the dystopia as well.
How do you feel about how the different elements of Inside work together to create a cohesive piece? Because I feel like this game, more than others, does a really good job of kind of being, I guess, just cohesive. Like it feels like one whole game, like yes. one piece, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, and I really love that, like, you kind of are already mentioning that sort of instinct, that instinctual characteristic of the game, and speaking about it as like one singular thing rather than a combination of disparate pieces, because while the game certainly is made of disparate pieces, like, it is an actual thing that exists in code, and there are different aspects of it that made it come together, all of that fades away. Like, when you play the game, you're not thinking about any one part of it, and when you talk about it, you sort of go and you'll end up going in circles, because one aspect of the game will lead you to thinking about the next one, and that'll lead you back into thinking about some other thing, and then next thing you know, you're remembering a different sequence. And the fact that you kind of can continuously bounce through it shows that the game is less about viewing it as a finished state or as like a finished interpretation, and really the unique value of this game is the act of moving through it. And the fact that the game is, in my opinion, characterized by that movement shows the life that it has, because when you think about things in an abstract kind of philosophical way, like, movement is life, and a static state is death. And so the fact that this game is so full of life and so full of movement is why I think it is such a artistic masterpiece, and why it continues to and will continue to resonate with anyone who touches it, you know. And I think that when one person does start to try to pick things apart, you then start to think, like, you know, like, you're it's like, what's the point, you know? Like, a very common quote is that something is greater than a sum of its parts. And that is actually a misquote from a German philosopher who says that an artwork is something other than the sum of its parts. And when you think about it as in terms of an other, it's basically that all of these things together create something that's totally different. And that's basically exactly what you are saying, that Inside ceases to be a combination of video game code and light engines and animations, and it ends up being one singular thing, and that is the experience of playing Inside, you know?
Yeah, and, like, I mean, in the setup, I gave a quick description of the gameplay elements, right? It's a puzzle platformer. You go through, you overcome obstacles, you run, you swim, you do all these things, right? Like, I could talk about the gameplay of Inside as opposed to, like, what the soundtrack is, and as opposed to, like, what the world is, and the story, and all this stuff. But I feel like, at the end of the day, for this game, it seems more fruitless to do that as opposed to, like, other games, right? Where I think of, like, Batman Arkham Asylum or Arkham City, right? Where it's an open world, right? You have essentially, like, check marks to check off in terms of, like, checking off side quests, and you have the combat, and you have the stealth, right? And these things, like, they work together to create a whole game.
Yeah.
But, like, I think for Inside, right, when you compare the two, Inside's disparate parts definitely come together to create something that is, I feel like, just more unique and more whole, if that makes sense. And one of the games that we're going to touch on this podcast in a later episode is The Witness, which is a puzzle game by Jonathan Blow. And I believe as he was creating that game, he was talking about how he wanted to make a game that was, I guess, honest. And this is me kind of putting my own interpretation of what he said, and I can't remember the exact quote, but he essentially, like, talked about a game like Call of Duty, right? And Call of Duty is a game that is set, depending on which one you're playing, is set in World War II, for example, right? And you have a bunch of guns, and you have soldiers and all this stuff. But at its core, Call of Duty is really just a video game about shooting. It's a video game about shooting your friends, or it's about shooting bots. But really, it is about lining up a shot and shooting and experimenting with different weapons and all that stuff. And so for The Witness doesn't really have a story. It doesn't really have a narrative. It doesn't really have much. It has meaning, but in terms of what it's trying to say explicitly, like, there's not really much there in terms of that. And it seems like he wanted to make that game a puzzle game and a very honest puzzle game, right? The Witness is a game about puzzles.
Right.
That's what the game is about. And I feel like Inside has a similar thing going on, where Inside does have an aesthetic over its mechanics. It does have things that you can look at and kind of understand to mean something. And it does have, it has characters, it has moments, it has all these things, right? But all these elements do work together to create something that feels honest and feels like something that isn't just the layering on of, like meaningless, I don't know, like meaningless story, meaningless, yeah. You feel what I mean.
I understand what you say, and it's interesting to use the adjective honest, because some of the philosophers that I read who talk about art speak of the best artworks as artworks that are true. Mm-hmm. And that's a really weird way to think about an object, is to look at it and ask yourself, is this thing true? And that is a very ambiguous question, and it's hard to even understand and answer. But these people who believe that art exists will say that the best pieces are true. And you know, that essentially means that, like, by virtue of one particular object's form, it kind of creates its own identity, and it creates something almost out of nothing. And
yeah,
I think what you are highlighting here is that if we speak about Inside as just its formal qualities, just its qualities of its engine and its jumps and its puzzles and things, we're going to quickly realize that there's something we're leaving out. And that something, I think you and I could do this podcast for 3 hours and we would never actually put words onto it, because there's actually something here that is like pre-linguistic. Like there is a feeling or an expression in this game that the moment we even put words onto it actually detracts from it and actually mischaracterizes it.
Yeah. It's almost like a magic. Like,
exactly.
I remember playing Breath of the Wild and feeling that way, right? Where I was like, man, I can't believe this game exists. And there's something about it, aside from its individual elements, that makes this game special, right? And
exactly.
It's like, it is a weird magic that's hard to put into words, and it's hard to really...
It's aesthetic experience.
Express. Yeah. No, exactly. Some more tidbits. The huddle, or the blob, the amalgam of body parts that the player controls at the end of the game, had been an idea for the game since 2010, when animator Andreas Normand Grontved had been brought aboard Playdead to do preliminary animations for it, based on a drawing by artist Morten Bramsen. Bramsen's drawing of the huddle served to guide much of the visual nature and art style for the rest of the game. To animate it, Grontved took inspiration from the motion of Nago, the demon form of the boar god from Princess Mononoke.
Oh, wow.
The squishiness, yeah, that's actually really cool. I didn't even realize that when I was like before I was doing research, I had no idea.
Yeah.
The squishiness of the main character of the game is Gish and human behavior during crowd surfing. Grontved developed initial animations using what he called the huddle potato, and simplified the geometries to demonstrate how the being would move and interact with the environment. Whereas most of the other game animations were based on a combination of preset skeletal movements along with the physics engine, the huddle had to be animated nearly entirely by a custom physics model developed by Thomas Krog and implemented by Lassie John Folgsang Peterson.
Getting Danish on you, dude.
Yeah, super Danish. That's like four names in one. Soren Trotner Madsen and Mikkel Bogeksen, Bogeskov, Svedsen. This has been the hardest episode in terms of names. And I've already recorded an episode on Hellblade, which goes into some also pretty difficult ones. This model uses a 26-body simulation of the core of the huddle, driven by a network of impulses based on the direction of the player and the local environment, which allowed the huddle to reconfigure itself as it needed in certain situations, such as fitting into tight spaces, which is really cool. I remember like there's one scene in particular where like you had to fit through a door, and the thing just naturally gets in there, and just looks super cool.
That's just insane.
They then added 6 arms and 6 legs with some preset animations that would also help to drive the impulse in the main body simulation. The skin of the huddle was a mix of art styles borrowed from the sculptures of John Isaacs and the art of Jenny Seville and Rembrandt. The vocals and body sounds were performed by the renowned Danish-Austrian performance group Cygna. So a lot of cool information there about the blob or the huddle. Just such a cool thing. Such a cool piece of work.
Yeah, that huddle is. You can just hear the like how making that thing come to fruition was probably a massive portion of the entire development of the game, you know.
And it seems to be like the thing that drove the whole game's development was the huddle, because it seems like they started with it, or at least in terms of like the visual design of the game, they started with the huddle and kind of worked from there. And so
I was doing some research as well, and they basically said that like they had no design documents, they didn't have any sort of production tracking, they just outlined like a few key moments of the game and would hand an artist a piece of the environment, and then that artist would kind of make it and then pass it to the next one, and then that artist would like remake it. And they did this iterative process where they were just like working over each other for years and years and years until like literally every single detail was purposeful. And
man,
you can just feel it, like the way even in the very first sequence the boy like snaps a twig and that cues the guard to turn around, and then once you see his mask you're already like on watch, and then you see the flashlight come out. And then once the flashlight's out, he turns it on, and then he starts walking towards you. And it's like when you're playing the game, you're not looking at those all of those cues as like something that you should be taking note of, but you just know instinctively, oh fuck, this guy's coming to get me, right? And so you can just, through their process, they just made sure that everything was in the perfect and right spot. And I also just love the main visual motifs of the game. Like they have these really big exaggerated objects throughout most of it, like abandoned machinery, old boards, there's like lights, cameras, like old subways, gigantic hatch doors, and it just has like a very 1960s like modern like architect or secret agent type of vibe. And it's just it has its identity, you know, and it's a really special game to just look at. And this is very much a cliche, but I still think it holds true that you can screenshot that game anywhere and fucking make a background.
Yeah.
Of it, you know?
Yeah. It's really awesome. And I've actually heard like a similar thing, like a similar sentiment with Dance Cruise. This is like very much, this is gonna be like the weirdest analogy that I make on this podcast as a whole, but like so people who know me know that I have somewhat of a dance history. I used to like dance on dance teams or whatever, right? And I remember I forget if it was an interview or where I heard this said, but essentially like a lot of the best hip hop dance crews, if you want to make great choreography, make it so that like you can take a picture at any point during the choreography and it looks like a painting.
Nice.
Like create, like make great visuals, make great silhouettes. That's how you know you made a great piece of choreography, is when you can take a picture at any moment and it can look, even as a still image, it can look incredible.
Yeah.
And Inside has that, right? Where like, take a screenshot anywhere in the game and it looks like a painting I could put on my wall.
Definitely.
So the next segment is, why do we believe this game is special? Before every podcast, I'll ask the guests to give me an element that they believe this makes the game special. And you actually expressed the huddle, which we've talked about a lot. Now, I don't know if you had any more to add to your thoughts on the last portion of the game.
Yeah, I mean, I just think that last 30 minutes of gameplay is so exhilarating. And you spoke about the sequences of running with this blob and throwing objects. And it just feels so natural that while it may not make sense visually what the hell is going on, it makes sense and it feels good physically. Like, your hands just know what to do. And I've always been someone who likes to try to bring up the physical aspects of play. And I think that the way this game feels in that final 30 minutes when you're controlling this new avatar that you've just been introduced to, mm-hmm. and just by virtue of what's happening on the screen, you know that you can control this thing differently from the boy. And instinctually, the game crafts your instincts and then makes sure to reward them by making whatever you think you can do the way to progress through the level. And I just remember playing, and it's funny, that sequence in particular where you have the flaming box and you're throwing it over the sprinklers, that moment is seared into my brain, and it was one of those moments where I was like, this is unbelievable, you know?
Yeah, because even like the way the box kind of passes from hand to hand mm-hmm. on the blob, super cool and just super well done, and that kind of leads me to like my element that I'm bringing, which is the amount of detail present and the animation in the game, because like you mentioned it earlier where it feels like there's an animation for everything.
Yes.
Like, you kind of just want to see like all the ways that you can, like, what all the death animations are in the game, because it feels like they've Playdead has taken every moment into account and figured out how to put detail into it, like just from like getting mauled by dogs, right?
Yeah.
Or like drowned by the siren, or falling off a particular cliff, right? Like, it feels like they've thought of every way a player can play this game and have accounted for it.
Yes.
And looking at the blob, all the movements, all the way the thing moves, and the way it goes into a door, or even like the way they illustrate how powerful the blob is, right?
Yeah.
You press circle if you're playing on PlayStation to move something, or to like pull a door or something like that, right? And like, you have that instinct as the blob to be like, okay, cool, there's a handle here, or there's like a thing here that I need to get through and I need to pull it off. And so like, you do it, and like, you just pull the whole wall off the wall. You just rip it down, because like, the blob is huge, the blob is powerful, and they do a really good job of illustrating that, and it makes you feel super cool, and it gives you that sense of power playing as a blob. And so, yeah, really cool, really dope. Let's get into categories, which is the last segment of the show.
All right.
Every episode, I ask essentially the same questions each episode. To see it, like, how this game kind of compares to the other games that we talked about on the show. The first category is called the Indie Factor. What does this game do to capture the spirit of indie game development?
Yeah, so I think this one has a different side of what indie can mean. You know, sometimes mm-hmm. indie is a single person and realizing a total vision. Sometimes indie is, like, fast and nimble and has, like, a lot of attitude. To me, this kind of indie project, you know, they're working in a framework of European government where they can get art grants and things like that to fund themselves. And with the security that they got from Limbo, plus just their, I would say, technical prowess and own design chops, basically, they were able to sit down and say, we're going to make something and we're not going to release it until it's done. And you can't necessarily do that when you're on deadlines and you're on budgets and you're on, financial quarterly plans. And so the mm-hmm. fact that they are able to just, in the freedom of their own studio, make this game until every last T was crossed and I dotted, I think is sort of how indie feels when it comes to talking about Inside in particular.
Nice. Yeah, I do wonder, I want to know, like, and I don't know if these numbers are out there, but like, in terms of like how well the game sold, because mm-hmm. like, when I think of indie game development, I do think of like the unique games out there that, you know, you wouldn't necessarily see from a AAA publisher because of their sales power, right? Like, this isn't a first-person shooter. This isn't, like, something that's going to have wide mass appeal. It is, though, a super quality puzzle, like the highest of quality is actually like puzzle platformer.
Exactly.
That like, you know, like with, it's hard to really sell a puzzle platformer on the box, and Inside is definitely one where it's like you have to, you kind of have to show it to somebody for them to be like, oh, like this is cool, like this is special.
Yeah.
But yeah, like when I usually think of like the indie factor, my example is usually like Undertale, which yeah, I do think is like the other side of the coin, where like Undertale is a game with like that attitude, with like a bunch of like humorous writing from one main developer, small in scope, but you know, super cool and super awesome, right? Like this is like, hey, we're giving this to a small team, but they have they're given like a lot of financial backing. They're given time. They're given they have the expertise. Like they have all the elements that they need to create like a good and focused game experience. And they're given the freedom to do that.
Yeah.
And the end result reflects that. And so yeah, like I'm with you that I think it does reflect that portion.
Nice.
The next category is called Successful Successor. Can this game get a sequel that lives up to it?
You know, it's funny. I just read while researching this that that Playdead is not doing a 2D side-scroller anymore, and that their next game will be a 3D.
Really?
Yeah, it'll be a 3D third-person science fiction game. And
interesting.
What Art Jensen said, and Art Jensen has been described by those around him who work with him as a genius, and I believe it, have basically, Art Jensen said that like they feel like they've done everything they can do with the 2D genre. They feel at this point like it is now a creative constraint to them. And so I think that they can make games like Inside again, definitely, but this game doesn't really need a sequel, or I don't think is a good candidate for one. I think it makes sense Limbo to Inside, and when you see the change, I think you recognize that Inside does in some ways put an age on Limbo that is hard to take away. But I can't possibly think what, I mean, that's, I mean, they would maybe figure out a way, but the fact that they don't want to do any more 2D games, and that this game is such like a magnum opus, like no, I would be happy for literally anything that they release, or any trailer I see, I will be excited. And if it was another 2D game, I would still be just as excited. But I don't think it really needs a sequel.
Yeah, and I'm kind of with you there. This is an interesting one to ask this question for, because like Inside isn't necessarily a sequel to Limbo, but it can be seen as a successor to Limbo. And I think like, yeah, in comparison between the two, like Inside definitely lives up to Limbo and even surpasses it. I think in most eyes. But like, I don't know how you would even make an Inside 2 if you wanted to.
Right.
I don't know. Like, I don't think you can really like pick up from. I mean, I guess I probably would play a whole game as a Blob. Like if they made a 2-hour experience from like, where does the Blob go from here?
This I'll time play the Blob is just taking it, itself apart throughout the entire course of the game.
Yeah, like at the end of the game, you turn into a boy.
Yeah,
like how does that work? And I guess I would play that game, but it's not a sequel that I feel like needs to exist. And I feel like that, I feel like making that sequel would then even take away from Inside. I feel like it is one of those cases where the story of Inside feels. Definitive is a weird word, but it does feel definitive, even though it is mysterious.
Yes.
Like I don't necessarily need a definitive interpretation of like what the story is through a sequel. I think what we have is good and perfect the way it is. And I don't think you can make more of a game existing in this world without taking away from what already is.
I agree.
The next category is called play of the game. Does this game have a most important moment?
Yes, I think the moment that you can that you meet the Blob and control him is the is the wow factor. And you know, I think maybe not a lot of games do have that, and this one just has such an obvious one, but it is full of moments. You know, I will also give a shout out to the mimic puzzle, which is very early in the game, where you fall in line of these marching people, and you have to mimic all of their movements. And it is a brilliant puzzle. It's super tense. I think it holds interpretive weight. Like when I apply my sort of collectivist critique onto the game, to me that is the like metaphor that if you you cannot have free will in this world and you must think and act like everybody else or else you will be killed. Mm-hmm. Like that's sort of how that scene speaks to me. And so I think that moment works on so many different levels, and I'll give a shout out to that one too.
Yeah, no, that's a really great one for sure. And just from a puzzle design perspective, the portion of the game where you essentially have to go around collecting like all of the different the mindless people, you have to like get like 20 of them to stand on a pad, and you have to like go around from like corner to corner collecting them. Mm-hmm. That was just like a really cool puzzle to solve in a game where each of the puzzles and inside feel short and to the point, and small. You're moving on to the next one. Yeah, you're moving on to like the next mechanic. You're moving on to the next thing the game is trying to teach you. That one kind of dragged on, but it didn't drag on in a bad way. It kind of like it kind of gave you a reason to kind of use your mind more and kind of think like, okay, cool. Like, what is the thing here? How do I get these people over here?
Yeah.
How do I lead these people out? And inside with his puzzles is overall like not that difficult. There comes a few moments where I find myself, where I found myself stopped the second time playing around. Mm-hmm. And it's been 3 years, so like I didn't memorize all the solutions to the puzzles.
Right.
But like I found myself stuck, but no more than like 2 to 3 minutes.
Yeah, exactly.
Of like being like, what do I need to do? And so to get to that part where I'm rounding up all those different, all the different people, I was like, okay, cool. Like this is a thing that I can actually focus on and think about a little bit. So that was like a good moment of the game for me.
Cool.
This last category is called Masterpiece Doesn't Mean Perfect. If you could change one thing about this game, what would it be? And this is kind of a hard one for this question, I feel like.
Yes.
But I'm curious if you have anything that comes to mind.
Yeah, I think it speaks to the caliber of this game that I mean, truthfully, I wouldn't touch a thing. But if I had my way, I would actually say that I would remove the secret ending from the game.
Okay.
I think that collecting the different pieces is fun, you know, like finding the secrets is fun, but
mm-hmm.
I thought the original experience of the first playthrough was so powerful that when I found out in the weeks after that there was a secret ending and, oh, what does the secret ending mean for the story? I was almost like, I didn't want to think about it anymore. So I was like, ah, who cares? Like in the same way that I actually don't play DLC for like some of my favorite games of all time, like Dark Souls, just because like I have the core experience and that's fine for me. I would actually remove the secret ending of this game just so I didn't have to think about it.
Yeah, I think I'm with you there. I agree with you because I found the secret ending, is the secret ending the one where you kind of go back to the first bunker and
yes.
you see that there's somebody controlling the game. Okay, yeah. I remember like finding that after I'd beaten the game, and in a game where I feel like there are so many interpretations to be had of what is going on. Getting to that ending, I was kind of just like, I don't know what this, this is a certain factor into everything that's going on here that I almost just rather not
exactly.
take into account.
Yeah, and I think it does make some of the rest of it rather meaningless. Like it becomes mm-hmm. so abstract at that point that there's like, then it's like,
yeah,
it's just like a fool's errand to even try, you know?
Yes, exactly. But awesome. Yeah. And that brings us to the end of the podcast. Chase,
yes.
thank you again so much for joining me on this one. I'm really glad I've gotten to talk about this game again because I didn't realize I missed this game until I played it. And I was like, man, people need to come back and revisit this game more because it's an awesome one.
I agree. And thank you so much for having me on. It was a pleasure to not only talk with you about games, as it always is, but to mm-hmm. have the opportunity to speak about Inside, which I am very passionate about, is very special to me. So thank you for the opportunity, dude. And I am excited to see hopefully more people either return to it or pick it up for the first time.
Yeah. Of course, if you're listening, you can follow Chase on Twitter at Bodacious Chase. Chase is a product manager at InnoGames. Check out what he has to say. You post a lot of like cool like philosophy type stuff regarding video games. You like read a lot, and you kind of post some of your notes. and they're always good reads because you kind of I feel like I'm more enlightened anytime nice. I come across any of them.
Awesome.
So definitely check out Chase on Twitter once again at Bodacious Chase. Next episode, we are talking Cuphead. Yes, Cuphead. Episode after that, we're talking Hellblade's newest sacrifice. So please stay tuned. And yeah, until next episode, we'll see you guys later.
Bye, everyone.